So this sort of laid the groundwork for many of the decisions that we've subsequently made in terms of treating women essentially as a sort of reserve labor force that we can pull into the paid workforce when we want them there and then push them back out again.
Hello, and welcome to The Feminist Present, a podcast that uses the gift of feminism to figure out what's going on right now. I'm Adrian Dodd.
I'm Laura Good. I was really hoping you were going to try the movie phone thing again. I was thinking about movie phone.
lame 90s references are so last episode.
It's true. Are something we reserve only for really special moments. What's going on? It's Monday. We're alive. Happy Pride Month.
Yeah. Happy Pride Month to all those who celebrate and or have takes on it, which is all of us. And we have a pretty exciting, although not super queer, episode for you. A episode really all about the patriarchy. And
it's a bummer.
It's good.
It's a bummer.
It's a good bummer.
It is a good bummer. I mean, Jess Calarco is so cool. Okay, so the backdrop here is, so during the pandemic, a sociologist out of the University of Wisconsin at Madison named Dr. Jessica Calarco had been going about her life as a scholar, doing really well, publishing scholarly works, and then she went completely viral through an interview with Anne Helen Peterson for a single line that is so indelible, it will never leave me. Most countries have social safety nets. The U.S. has women. And any person, I can't name a single person I know who would be shocked to hear that that really resonated during the pandemic and its specific labor concerns. So, yes, while this is only a queer conversation by virtue of our gay involvement, then these issues are evergreen, unfortunately. It would be so nice to reach a point where these issues were not evergreen.
We just had
such a fun party for the 50th anniversary of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research, and one of the topics that was covered was like, wouldn't it be nice for this work to be completely irrelevant and unnecessary? But we're not there yet.
Fun fact that apparently when it was first proposed, the cognizant dean asked Myra Strober, who was the first director of the institute, whether they would agree to sunset it, quote, once those issues had all been solved. And she said, yes, I'm very comfortable promising you that. Because even in 1974, she was like, yeah, I'm not going to hold my breath.
And 50 years later, here we are, still having really fun parties. It was an unusually fun party.
Yeah, it's a very good party.
But yeah, we learned so much. I mean, I just love the way Jess lays out the policy history of how we got to such an unsupported point as a nation. And it's no accident. It's just, it did not happen by accident.
Yeah. And the book, I should say, is coming out June 4th.
Yes.
It's really quite brilliant. And it is really interesting, as you're saying, like, it's one of those things. There are books that blow your mind by giving you information you never had. This is a book in which I feel like the number of like discrete data points that I did not have any idea about, like, is really, really small. Yeah. It's the way they're put together into relationship. Like, oh shit, that is a dynamic I've never thought about. Right.
Totally.
And it's a book that really is able to make super sophisticated theoretical points while being really based on just unbelievable amounts of interviews, which is another really cool thing to be able to sort of generate some pretty bracing insights from just finding out how people are dividing labor. I mean, it's a storied and I think very, very productive vein in sociology to just kind of get people talking about how they arrange their everyday lives. I think that's ever since, you know, from Goffman on, basically, mm-hmm. is my impression that like you don't, this reliably furnishes some pretty great data because people like, right, both are experts on their everyday lives and don't reflect on them that much. And so like, we'll tell you some pretty outrageous shit. If you're just like, oh, it's just 20 questions here. Just like, you know, do you hit your kids?
Yeah.
You know, and like, whoa, there it is.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I was blown away at, she must've done such a good job setting up those research interviews and getting people comfortable to talk to her, because people revealed, here's how many times I've yelled at my kids this week, here are my attitudes towards physical discipline. That part was so interesting. The interlocking she did between Christian values and physical discipline is worth the price of admission alone. And like for anybody who might not, you know, spend all their time reading sociological texts, which I definitely don't, this is such a readable book. It was so approachable.
Oh yeah.
Like in the Netflix recommendations of our previous episodes, like if you're fans of Anthony Ocampo or Angela Garbez or Liz Lenz or Lydia Kiesling, you're going to love Jess Calarco.
Yeah. And I mean, I think maybe we should just leave it at that. And just, I mean, because it's basically, she does an incredible job of just laying out the overall stakes of the book. So why not let her explain her own work? And for now, we hope you enjoy and we hope you go out and buy this book.
Yes, the book is Holding It Together. The author is Jess Calarco. And here is our interview with her, which we thoroughly enjoyed.
Enjoy.
So we are here with Dr. Jessica Calarco. Okay, I have to tell you, when my best friend finished her PhD in English, we added fucking awesome to her doctoral title. And I think we might have to do the same for you because I think you might be Dr. Jessica fucking awesome Calarco based on this book.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I am a real devotee of acknowledgements pages as like a source of a lot of intel. And I was so touched by what you wrote about your mom in yours. So I wonder if that might be a place to begin this conversation. Tell us about Anne McCrory and what was her deal and what did she do and how did she bring us here?
Sure. So my mom, I mean, I think she is someone who has, I feel echoes of her story in so many parts of this book and in so much of the work that
she
do. She and my dad got married when my mom was 19, when she was in college, and, you know, had me not long after that. And at the time, you know, childcare was a huge challenge. They had moved for my dad's job across state lines away from extended family. And so, you know, figuring out how to stay in college and manage childcare was a deeply challenging situation for her, as it was for many of the moms that I talked to for this book. And so for her, that meant, you know, putting her career, she had wanted to be a child psychologist. That was kind of her initial dream in going to college, and had to put that on hold in terms of raising me, and ended up in kind of a number of different sort of low wage jobs, working sort of secretarial types of work and doing other types of administrative work just to kind of make ends meet. Oftentimes, she and my dad tried sort of a split shift when I was young, in terms of she was home with me and then she'd go work the night shift. And, you know, that was deeply challenging for so many reasons, as it was for other couples that I talked to who tried to manage the childcare crisis that way. And this was, you know, this was, and so she ended up, you know, maybe not surprisingly, especially once my younger siblings were born, you know, dropping out of the workforce for a while. Though certainly was
the paid workforce. Let's say the paid workforce.
Absolutely. Yes.
She was working her butt off.
Oh my gosh. Absolutely. And even there, like was doing as much paid work as she could, even as a stay-at-home mom, in terms of, you know, selling Mary Kay makeup and eventually starting her own home child care center where she was caring for other people's kids in addition to caring for my siblings and me, and, you know, use that as a sort of springboard to think about getting back into the paid workforce. But this meant, you know, for her, going back to college and getting a degree at that point, it was less about child psychology, which felt kind of too far afield from what she'd be able to manage, and instead thought about getting a degree in elementary education, which is how she ended up when I was in middle school, you know, going back to work full time and working as a teacher. It's, you know, and so kind of this pathway from being, you know, first a, you know, mom trying to figure out childcare, to then going back to leaving college and having to figure out other kinds of options, and thinking about, you know, childcare as one of those sort of stopgaps that many women end up falling into, especially when they have young children at home themselves, that this becomes a sort of pathway for many women to find paid work that makes it possible for them to have young children themselves, but also contributes to the devaluation of that work and to the underpayment of that kind of work, which we can certainly talk more about too. But this was, so she is someone who is, you know, deeply inspirational for me in terms of her kind of willingness to figure it out, but also someone who reminds me of the toll that this takes on women, and particularly mothers, in terms of the sacrifices that they make with their paid work and to their bodies and to their minds and to their relationships in the process of trying to hold it together for all of us.
I have never seen a split shift like succeed in like mental health or marital health, but that it's not like people are crazy for trying it. Sometimes that's the best of the bad options, you know? Seems no accident to me, Jess. Are you the oldest of three or the oldest of four?
Oldest of three.
Okay. Adrian knows that I'm obsessed with birth order, and he's like cringing as he feels me edging into this topic.
No, I mean, I've it's just priced in at this point.
But it feels very relevant to this topic matter that you were a parentified oldest child trying to help out an overworked mom. Does that feel relevant to you, Jess?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so my two younger siblings are 5 and 7 years younger than I am. And so for me, that was enough of an age gap that once my mom thought about going back to work or back to school to go to so that to potentially become a teacher, that meant I was the one who could be home with the kids in the afternoon to some extent in terms of, you know, getting my younger siblings off the bus, getting dinner started, you know, doing chores around the house, later driving them around places to be able to sort of help make that work in a way that might not have been possible otherwise, given the high cost of childcare in terms of, you know, other possible options for caring for younger kids.
Which is such a perfect example of exactly the kind of taped together stopgap mechanism that American families have no other choice but in your book. Okay, so let's fast forward about 40 years to this moment where you're talking to Anne Helen Peterson and this, like, tell us about this quote going viral and how that was for you, you know, as a career academic.
Sure. So this was, you know, this is a project that I'd started before the pandemic, you know, back in 2018 I was at the time kind of interested in the best laid plans of parenthood in terms of how we have these ideas about the kind of parent that we want to be, and life intervenes in lots of ways to push us off course. Indeed. And so I'd started this project and the pandemic hit in the middle of the data collection. And this was, you know, 250 families with young children that we'd been following since 2018. And it just became so apparent so quickly how much of an impact the pandemic was having on families with young kids, and particularly on the moms with those families, who were often the ones kind of disproportionately scrambling to figure out childcare. And on top of that, figuring out elder care situations and figuring out how to manage health crises and kind of doing the work for their families and their communities of trying to hold it together in the face of this crisis. And so at the time, it sort of, I had a moment, my own kids were 5 and 2 at the time. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, how do I do this with my own, you know, my own childcare challenges at home. But it felt imperative in that moment to keep the project going and to feel, in part because of the challenges that so many of these moms that we've been following for so long already were facing. And so figuring out how to continue doing that work. And that led to, you know, trying to get the word out about what was going on with families of young kids, even from a fairly early stage in the pandemic, which led to, you know, some media interest in these kinds of topics. And in particular to this interview that I did with Anne Helen Peterson for her culture study newsletter, which was fairly new at the time. Mm-hmm. She is an amazing interviewer, and it comes up with sort of the incredibly deep and insightful questions that kind of hit at the heart of the matter, kind of right from the start. And so that interview, one of the parts of the interview, I talked about how kind of other countries have social safety nets and the US has women. And that quote, I think, really resonated with folks in part
because... Oh, did it, Jess? Oh, God, did it. I mean, I think I forwarded that newsletter to at least 10 people myself. So, like, yes, just anecdotally, yes, that hit.
Well, thank you. And certainly, I think it resonated in part because this was a moment where it became very clear that a stronger social safety net would help. In the sense of, you know, we could make different choices. We could have made different choices leading up to the pandemic, and those kinds of investments in social safety net programs and structures would have made it less likely that mothers would have just been sort of relied upon as the default to make it work in those moments, and might have gotten us, you know, more easily through the kinds of challenges that we faced during the pandemic as well. And so I think this kind of was a moment where we could see the resonance and the relevance of that kind of investment in social safety net programs, and also how the absence of it makes it so possible to end up simply relying on women by default instead. And so I think that was, for me, a sort of wild moment in the sense of how deeply this resonated and how far it went in terms of kind of the public attention to this. But it also gave me the push that I needed to sort of rethink what I was going to do with these data and kind of how this might come together into the book that I ultimately ended up writing, as opposed to maybe the more academic-y version that I initially envisioned for the project.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. It also feels like, right, I mean, like, the book is clearly based on very careful study, very careful observation, but that pandemic moment also sort of pushes you to a question, sort of almost like a whodunit, right? Where it's like, we, as you say in your 8th chapter, like, we were able to do kind of the rudiments of some of this in 2020, and then it went away, right? Like, and it's like, what? Well, who did that? Why did this happen? And, like, I guess that does kind of take you away from the kitchen table. It takes you away from families sort of making these impossible kind of calculations, and it gets you towards, like, I mean, a question that, I mean, Betty Friedan was wrestling with in the 1960s already. How does what's the investment? Is that, is this capitalism? Is it patriarchy? Or what combination of them is doing the rollback here? What ensures that anytime you start building up, the basics here, they have to get knocked back down?
Absolutely. And I think those were core questions that came out of the pandemic for me, was sort of, how did we get here? How did we get to this point where we could simply accept the reliance on women by default, as opposed to building these stronger social safety nets? And then there was also this moment during the pandemic, in late 2021, early 2022, where it seemed like we might build back better, like where we might actually have a chance at building the kind of social safety net that other countries have long taken for granted. And, when that failed, and then adding things like the Dobbs decision on top of that, it became this sort of even deeper question about why, even when we had this moment where we thought we could do better, did we, if anything, pull back and go in the opposite direction instead? And so kind of what's that question of whodunit, I think, is, has been a driving force for me, and was helpful in the book in terms of thinking beyond my own data and pulling in evidence from history, evidence from cultural analyses, to be able to figure out the larger story of the forces that are shaping these individual people's lives.
I mean, spoiler alert for the listener, like, American policy is the culprit here. and Jess, you do such a fantastic, extensive, thorough job of road mapping us through why, right? Like, I guess one question I have is, why are you a sociologist? Not that I think you should be, but you're also such an interesting historian. And there was so much historian, like, mile marking that had to take place to tell this story. So how did we get here? I mean, could we start with where the shocking moment where you begin, and in World War II, where we like almost did do this? Can you tell us about that historical surprise?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. To your question, I think part of it comes from my own training. When I was an undergraduate student, I had the chance to work as a research assistant for a historian who did kind of education history research. And so I really like archival work. Yeah. And kind of the ins and outs of figuring out that kind of whodunit story of how did we get here. So I have some training in that sense, though I like sociology for how it pushes us to think about not just the individual actions that led to some outcome, but thinking about it as larger structural systems and social forces, and how those tend to pattern not only historical events, but also people's lives in ways that have kind of deep ramifications for things like inequality. And so, on this front, one of those key kind of historical stories, one of these moments that I think is particularly illustrative, is this moment following, during and after World War II, where essentially the War Manpower Commission figured out during the war that they needed as many women in the workforce as possible to be able to support the economy while many men in the US were off fighting in war. And so what this meant at the time, we only had about one in three. So it was fairly easy to get, unmarried women and women without children into the workforce. There were lots of sort of propaganda campaigns designed mm-hmm. to sort of promote this, and very quickly got to almost 100% employment among those women. The challenge was, in particular, married women and mothers of young children. And those two things tended to go pretty much hand in hand at the time, just given what our society looked like. And so part of the challenge before that came from, why at the time only about one in 30 moms of young children were in the paid workforce. And so that had to do a lot with the fact that we just didn't have childcare options, that those kinds of, even the sort of makeshift partial system that we have today, it was far from that kind of a reality. And so for mothers, there was really no option, even if they were being told, yes, come join the work effort, come join the defense production effort. They didn't have that option without childcare. And so the government at the time was sort of persuaded to act on this, in part by using money from the Lanham Act, which was a defense spending bill designed to provide sort of key infrastructure in defense production centers around the US, to use some of that money to build high quality childcare centers and to fund them in ways that made that care, high quality care, broadly accessible for the families in those communities that needed to have moms in the paid workforce. And so
pause you there? That money came from the Defense Department?
Yes, very much so.
Somehow that missed me when I was reading it, but that is a really striking fact. Okay, please continue.
Yeah, I mean, this was treated as essential to the defense of our nation, given that maintaining not only the current, the domestic economy, but also the war production effort. These are, Rosie the Riveter's kids.
Fascinating.
Essentially.
Yes, and so totally.
Noticeably also, of course, the area of the economy that is most easily kind of, like, where everyone in the United States is allergic to a planned economy, the one place where they'll kind of allow it is when defense comes in.
Right.
Like, that's sort of where you know, Republicans can get behind some regulation, for instance.
Yeah. And even today, we do have childcare for military families.
Right.
But this is another place where we've continued to use defense spending to support childcare because it supports, you know, it supports the military effort. And so this is a place where we've been willing to make those investments in ways otherwise.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, is the defense budget also not the one unlimited budget in our federal legislature?
That's not my area of expertise, so I couldn't tell you that offhand, but
okay.
I think it's certainly a place where there seems to be some more flexibility than there is elsewhere.
I'll fact check that, but I believe that's true. Yeah.
No, that's okay. And so essentially, I mean, and it worked. I mean, these were high quality centers that offered care sometimes 10 or 12 hours a day, sometimes longer, plus, you know, after school care and summer care for older kids for usually less than $10 per day in today's dollars. And, you know, these were widely appreciated, that the women who were able to join the paid workforce because of these centers, you know, most of them, the vast majority of them wanted to keep their jobs after the war. And we'd substantially increased women's workforce participation. It went from 1 in 30 to 1 in 6 moms of young kids who were employed in the wake of these efforts. And this didn't even impact every community across the U.S. This was really only in sort of key defense production centers. And so imagine what we could have gotten to if we'd made this even broader than what we tried during World War II. Though certainly when the war ended and many other countries that put in place similar systems like France kind of kept it going and said, okay, we've made this investment, let's expand it outward, let's make this national, let's make this permanent. And that's not the direction that we decided to go, unfortunately. And instead, we opted to push women back home. And, you know, not only by shuttering the childcare centers, but also by putting back in place things like marriage bans that had existed before the war in terms of limits on married women's employment, limits on maternal employment, relegating women who wanted to stay in the paid workforce to the most sort of menial and low-paying kind of feminized jobs, as opposed to allowing them to compete in the workforce with men. And so this became sort of laid the groundwork for many of the decisions that we've subsequently made in terms of treating women essentially as a sort of reserve labor force that we can pull into the paid workforce when we want them there and then push them back out again as soon as we don't. And we sort of saw that in reverse happening during the pandemic in terms of the minute things sort of contracted, when the economy got tight, the first people to get cut were women, especially moms of young kids who were pushed out of the workforce. And so it was sort of this, you know, reverse pattern of what we saw during World War II.
I always think of, we interviewed the author Angela Garbez, who wrote Essential Labor during the pandemic. And I always, like, the single juiciest fact that I took from her research was that I believe it was 200,000 American women left the workforce in September 2020 alone when the kids went back to school. Like, if that doesn't prove what you're talking about, my God.
It was kind of layer after layer in the sense that it was not only were women the first ones pushed out of jobs in April and May when companies began to shut down or when kind of contractions happened, but then, you know, as soon as kids went back to school in the fall, when many places continued to remain kind of on a remote schooling schedule, that's a moment where many women, many mothers of young kids decided, I can't make it work. I'm so exhausted after the spring and the summer. And that was the case for many of the mothers that we talked to in our research in terms of, you know, just feeling so burned out by that point that it really seemed impossible to make it work any further.
It's also noticeable, right? I mean, the fact that this is sort of a post-war story, it's also, of course, the moment where sort of the nuclear family becomes the default model, right? And like, that's a story that weaves through a lot of the narratives in the book. The fact that, you know, clearly in earlier generations, there might have even been the ability to, you know, what happened to you, to kind of intergenerationally claim labor, to basically pass things downstream and have grandparents or older children take care of things. But of course, that gets harder as cars get involved and as people move for their jobs, right? And their child support in the shape of grandparents might be 4 states away.
Yeah. And even on top of the sort of the distance problem that many families have faced in terms of moving for opportunities in our society, we also have, you know, many lower income families, grandparents are working well into their 60s, 70s, 80s because they simply can't afford to retire. And so that limits the kinds of childcare options that many families have as well in terms of being able to rely on extended family to fill in those kinds of stop gaps in care. And I think that, you know, gets to the sort of larger pattern that I talk about in the book in terms of this great risk shift, in terms of how we've kind of shifted so much risk and responsibility onto families to manage and how that has kind of decimated communities and left them with, you know, not only nowhere to turn for support themselves, but so little support to give to others in the process as well.
Yes.
Right. Like you talk about the DIY society, and of course the other thing about the DIY society is that everyone is so busy managing their own lives that like there's nothing that radiates outward sort of in politically in a very small p, like just like you a concern or an ability to shape your larger community. You're just like, I'm sorry, I feel very strongly about this, but I have like 8 things I need to be doing right now.
Absolutely. And it gets at this idea that, you know, other countries have used social safety nets as a way to help people manage risk, as a way to help people avoid precarity, to pursue economic opportunity, and also to make sure that people have enough time and energy to contribute to a shared project of care, to make sure through things like, you know, paid family leave, paid sick leave, paid vacation time, that you have that kind of chance to participate in this kind of, you know, whether it's childcare, elder care, care for your community. And we don't have that when we push all this responsibility onto individuals and just say, figure out all that risk yourselves. You know, not only are we just scrambling to take care of ourselves in the context of so much risk, but it leaves so little left over to care for others in that process.
All of that. And the neoliberal trickle down doesn't work in the way that its engineers intended. Like, I'm thinking, just to call myself in, this weekend, I'm meeting a book deadline. I want to read Holding It Together. I have limited time. What do I do on Saturday? I order DoorDash so I don't have to add meal prep to my list of things to do because I'm a professional woman with a job. That falls so neatly in line with exactly the kind of risk shift you're describing and how this model of economic precarity forces us all into morally ambiguous at best choices. Like, I am so solidly in that category of highly educated women who have those choices, you know? I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the research you did around that class stratification.
Absolutely. So essentially, in this kind of a DIY society that we have, you know, it's too much risk for any of us to manage on our own. And that's particularly the case for people who can't manage risk for themselves, young children, elderly people, people who are sick, people who are dealing with disabilities. And so someone has to manage that labor. And in part because of the kind of gendered structures of our economy and the gendered sort of norms and ideologies that we hold in this country, that work disproportionately falls to women. And so, you know, once women are in that kind of a boat, it becomes, you know, they end up kind of in this situation where they're forced to fill in these gaps for everyone else. And that the work of that disproportionately falls to low-income women and to women in sort of who are particularly vulnerable, oftentimes disproportionately women of color, who are sort of have little choice but to do that work for their families and their communities because they have kind of like that example of, you know, their grandparents can't help out. Right. Their communities are so strapped that they have kind of nowhere to turn for support and nowhere to hide when other people ask them for help. And in that system, though, you know, women who are a little better off, college-educated women, higher-income women, do have more options because they can afford to outsource some of that risk and responsibility that comes with this sort of caregiver or with this kind of DIY system. And so, you know, that means things like childcare, things like DoorDash, things like, you know, paying someone to clean your home for you, paying someone to care for your elderly parents.
Exactly.
And certainly that, you know, comes with morally kind of ambiguous choices, though, in the sense that oftentimes to make those services affordable for families who need them, that work is deeply underpaid and disproportionately pushed onto low-income women, often women of color, who end up doing that work because it's the best option available to them. And many of those are moms of young children themselves, in part because of how we structure things like our welfare system, which forces oftentimes single moms of young kids to take whatever paid job they can find. And it's usually right. those kinds of, you know, filling in the gaps in our economy, filling in the kind of work that is too labor intensive and too difficult to outsource to actually generate a profit in our sort of market-driven capitalistic economy. Yes. So we need to push that work onto someone. And those someones, the people who are most vulnerable in this situation, are often low-income moms of young kids who just don't have that option otherwise. And so it's this complicated set of choices where for women to be able to get ahead in their careers, compete with men, have a sense of sanity, they end up we could solve this. We could invest in these kinds of social systems. We could make these government-funded programs. We could reduce the work pressure, the paid work pressure on people to, you know, have to spend as much time on their paid work as they do. But instead, we create this system where the best option for many people is to exploit someone else to be able to secure their own position.
Exactly.
Yeah, I once heard of a pitch during the time when everyone in San Francisco had a pitch. Someone wanted to like create an app that would connect people to au pairs and would take a cut. And I'm like, a cut of what? It's like you're taking the most underpaid workforce and you're trying to like make a few bucks on top of that. This is, you know, And I mean, I guess we that brings up also the question of immigration, right? Like that often it's not just people who, it's people who do not currently care for their own children because their own children are not here, right? Because they're being looked after by relatives, for instance, right? I mean,
the Philippines is such a classic example of that. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just you pointed out how underpaid these roles are, which is undoubtedly true. And another crucial point seems to be how unbenefited they are. You know, like I thought you made such an important economic point in noting how these businesses have razor thin profit margins, so they aren't investable and they don't scale the way capitalism wants businesses to scale. But also these businesses come with no sick days. They come with no healthcare. They, you know, and that makes these workers even more precarious.
Absolutely. I talked to one relatively, you know, high income family that was frustrated with the childcare crisis that they kept running up against,
yes.
you know, even before the pandemic and then certainly exacerbated by the pandemic in terms of there was a same-sex couple who, you know, wanted to share everything equally, wanted to do equal paid work, wanted to do equal childcare, but just kept running up against the limitations of our childcare system, couldn't even find a part-time spot for their daughter until she was 9 months old. And then after that, the pandemic hits. And so they just keep having to rearrange their care arrangements around the sort of limits on childcare. And eventually, even when the childcare center reopened during the pandemic, they were only operating on partial hours. They were only open from, I think it was like 9 to 4 because they couldn't get enough staff to keep it open any longer than that. They just couldn't fill the positions. And one of the moms went in and she was kind of ready to complain about this and frustrated about, you know, the lack of hours and what she saw as a decline in the quality of care during the pandemic, because so many of the experienced teachers had left. And what she got was sort of a lesson in the economics and of childcare, in the sense that she learned that many of these experienced teachers that the center had lost had left because they didn't have access to paid sick leave, they didn't have access to health insurance, and many of them were deeply in debt, in high levels of medical debt because of problems that they'd faced and because their salaries were so low that they couldn't afford
years of no benefits.
Exactly.
That's what happens. Yeah.
Well, and years of exposure to, let's be frank, some of the dirtiest
Absolutely.
People on the planet.
Indeed. And yeah.
I mean, like, I'm around a bunch of 3 and 4 year olds a lot, and like, I am just sick constantly. It's just, you know, the idea of someone doing that for 20 years, like, this person needs a platinum plan. Another thing I thought of, this is a point I'm stealing from friend of the pod, Sarah Marshall, but like, the casualization of babysitting, right? The way that becomes like this rite of passage and kind of problematized as like, oh, this is something that like girls do just like to make a little bit of extra money. It's like, this is serious childcare.
Crucial
and, like,
work.
You know, I'll include myself in this in the sense that my, one of our babysitters accused me of entering, quote, into a deflationary spiral. And I was like, who taught you this? You're 16.
San Francisco 16-year-old.
Anyway, right. And I was trying to argue her down. I thought it was still very fair. But so, yes, we were like, fine, we will not enter into the deflationary spiral.
Wait, was this in, I'm sorry, I need to zoom in on this. Did this come up in a rates discussion?
Yeah.
How did this?
I had been a little overenthusiastic in what I had promised, and I was trying to sort of lowball myself, and she called me out on it, because these are the children of Silicon Valley. They will not be meddled with. Yeah.
No. Indeed.
Yeah. So she drove a hard bargain. She's the only one who'll be able to make it work, I think. But everyone else, like basically, yeah, like isn't like, you know, babysitting is the cute kind of exploitation that we all kind of romanticize, right?
Very much so. And I think it gets at this idea that I was listening to a podcast the other day where one of the guests talked about how explained the devaluation of caregiving labor as the fact that, oh, anyone could do, these are jobs that anyone could do. These are jobs that require no formal
right.
training, that require no formal education and not high levels of skill. And oh, that just, you know, based on my own experience caring for children and my mother's experience and the many other people in this field that I've talked to, this is highly skilled labor that requires deep levels of commitment, that requires deep levels of patience and care and concern and knowledge of child development, at least to be done well. And just because we don't necessarily invest in it in those ways doesn't mean that this work doesn't require that. And to the point about babysitting, we're also training young girls to do this work from the time that they're old enough to hold a baby doll, you know, in the sense that quietly and in a way that we don't do for men, which then makes it seem as though, oh, this is just what women are naturally good at. And so it's, we don't see it as highly skilled labor because we don't see the training and the preparation and the sort of education, often informal education, that goes into this work in a way that the kind of education that happens for you know, masculine careers is often very visible in ways that caregiving education is much more informal and invisible behind the scenes. And so it kind of reinforces this devaluation of this type of work.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that's a really interesting point, and it gets at something. So, you know, as someone who yells about, you know, the perniciousness of the idea of natural, quote unquote, sort of gender roles, et cetera, like, I didn't need convincing, but it's fascinating in how often it pops up in your book. There are definitely places where I was still surprised as someone who professionally yells about this, where you point out stuff like the idea that like the de-skilling goes together with naturalness, that the, you know, there are all these places where our gender roles sort of like, it's like a jack in the box. It just sort of pops back and you're like, oh, there they are again, to mess it up for everyone. And like that's just to me, that's to me part of what really makes this book so remarkable. That you show that, like, no, there's so much downstream from that in places where no one would ever say, like, that's the crisis of our time. But, like, taken together, these interlocking systems are absolutely single-minded in what they make happen in our society.
And it's almost a self-reinforcing cycle in the sense that, you know, the more that we underinvest in the social safety net, the more of this kind of labor that we push onto women, the easier it actually is for people to buy into sexist myths. And that's what some of the data suggests, is that these kinds of, you know, belief that feminism has gone too far, belief that we're now hurting men by doing too much to help women, this is on the rise among young men. And that's what the data are showing. And I think this has to do with the fact that, you know, men don't want to think of themselves as bad guys, but we've structured this system in ways where oftentimes financially it makes sense, given things like the gender pay gap, to have women be the ones who sacrifice their careers.
Well,
within
Dad's making more,
and we know that he's probably going to make even more than that if he has a wife who stays home and kind of supports him or pulls back to part-time paid work. And so what that means is that, you know, for those men in those kinds of situations, these kinds of sexist myths, ideas like, oh, women are just happier at home, or it's just better for kids if moms are at home, become very appealing because it means they can feel like good guys even as they're exploiting the women around them. And it also means for women, if they've taken a step back in their paid work, or if they're not paid as much as their male counterparts, they can still feel value in what they're doing by buying into this idea that, oh, you know, maybe I am happier at home, or, oh, you know, maybe it is better for my kids if I'm here than if I'm focusing on my paid work. And so it becomes a way to kind of pacify ourselves and kind of feel better about these kinds of inequalities, which then ultimately make it easier, unfortunately, to continue to believe that we don't need that stronger social safety net. And so it's sort of this downward spiral that's pulling us not only into kind of deeper sexist beliefs, but also a kind of lack of willingness to push for a stronger safety net too.
I just have to meta comment that in the, 32 minutes we've been speaking, my children's underfunded public school has sent me 3 different volunteer opportunities in my inbox.
Oh, nice.
And like, I know they're going to my male co-parent too, but just like as an example.
Hi, moms.
Exactly. Yeah. No, you can't do that in San Francisco, Adrian. You can get shot for
but
that.
Like, I mean, like, but it's very much it's the unspoken part. Yeah.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And it's just like, just another opportunity to plug this hole.
Yeah, sure. Could a dad do a bake sale? I guess, like on a purely physical level, but like we all know how that's intended.
And it gets to this idea that it's not just childcare. I mean, it's also, I mean, we can think about, you know, we do fund a public education system, but we don't fund it well enough to actually eliminate the need for this kind of informal, you know, informal care work that goes into either raising additional funding or providing support with, you know, all of the activities that go into providing a high quality school experience. So it's another place where kind of stronger public funding could eliminate some of that work that we have to do as individuals to make it possible.
Just as like a tiny example of what you're talking about, like why is summer an emergency every year? You know, every year the school year lets out.
In a shocking twist,
yes,
it turns
exactly.
out there's a whole time when...
Oh, here's the 12 weeks you have to fill with no help again. Good luck. Jesus. Jess, you are such a good writer, and I loved the hardcore, rigorous sociological research you brought into this, and also like the absolute bangers with which you began your chapters. In particular, you just quoted this: in the US, we groom girls to stand in for the social safety net from the time they're old enough to hold a baby doll. Like, let me throw a parade for that sentence. I love this chapter. I think my favorite chapter was Good Choices Won't Save Us, which begins, rather than acknowledge the burden that women are carrying, the engineers of our DIY society have taken a page out of Garrett's playbook and gaslit the women who complain. I love that line. I was also so compelled. I don't know quite how to put this. You trained your sociological eye on specific behaviors that revealed what cracks were showing at the seams. One of them is violence. Could you talk a little bit about sort of what those behaviors were that red flagged for you as a sociologist and how you zeroed in on them?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly this is a place, you know, family life, especially when we put stress on families, this can lead to conflicts, you know, and, yes. and the conflict of our sort of DIY society where we've put so much of the responsibility for risk, so much of the responsibility for care onto individual families, you know, without communities that they can turn to. One of the risks that comes with this is a heightened risk of conflict within couples, and certainly a heightened risk of violence within those kinds of couples too. And I mean, we can even think about this in small ways, that it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, physical violence, but we can think about sort of verbal conflicts and how those escalate into kind of trauma for the people involved. One of the most sort of shocking and upsetting findings to come out of the surveys that my team and I did during the pandemic, we did a couple of national surveys with more than 2,000 parents each across the U.S. And the first one that we fielded was in December of 2020. And we asked parents, how often are you yelling at your kids? College-educated white dads were sort of off the charts compared to everyone else. Roughly 60% of them were saying that they were yelling at their kids at least once a day, compared to roughly 30% of everybody else. And really, what digging into the data, what was going on there was that these dads were disproportionately able to work remotely during the pandemic, but they also had, compared to moms who were in similar boats, much less experience with childcare and with trying to manage their paid work responsibilities well. Also caring for children. And that's what we heard time and again in the interviews that we did. Some moms even kind of pushed their partners to go back to paid work because it was getting too stressful to have their partners with them at home. And one mom, for example, I talked to, she had three kids at home during the pandemic. She was able to work remotely full time. And her partner, her husband, was able to work from home a couple days. And she eventually told him to stop coming because she talked about it as he's just yelling at the kids all the time. He's just frustrated that they won't do their schoolwork. And it's just not worth having him here. Even though she herself talked about how she had gained 40 pounds in 3 months, she was drinking more heavily, she was had gone back on antidepressants and gone back to therapy because of the stress that she was facing. And so it's not that it was easy for her, but that she, even with that, felt that she was still in a better position emotionally to manage the stress of this than her partner. And these were both, you know, highly educated, high income people. And so it's not, and we can only imagine how much more difficult and more precarious the situation is for families that are also, you know, struggling economically with job loss or with, you know, hardship in terms of affording rent, affording food. And so it certainly increases the risk of violence in those kinds of contexts as well.
It also made me think of that classic statistic about how, and I believe there's something about this that's specific to Wisconsin, which both you and I have a connection to, something like domestic violence spikes 10% every time the local football team loses. Like, the pandemic was that on a much grander scale, but I thought you did such an eloquent and compelling job. Both, I can imagine it might not have been an easy task just to get people to admit that they were yelling at their kids, and the way you, the non-judgmentality you approach that, both clearly in the questioning and in the research, really stood out to me in revealing these important truths that we have to talk about in order to be able to address.
Thanks. And yeah, I mean, this was not always easy research to do. And often,
I can imagine.
I mean, there were interviews where I, you know, bawled for a while after talking to some of these parents about the challenges they were facing in their lives and just, yeah, you know, hearing these stories and feeling, you know, and that's part of why I'm both deeply grateful to the families who shared their stories with me and also grateful for the opportunity to share those with others in the hopes that this can, you know, shed some light on these challenges that families in our society are facing and do so in a way that simultaneously helps readers to feel seen, to feel echoes of their own stories, but also to see beyond their own experience and to see why, you know, mothers or fathers or families that we might judge for making different choices than our own, you know, why oftentimes the choices that they're making are a product of the constraints that they face because of our larger policy choices.
And I mean, just to put a bow on that, I do think it's also worth sort of reflecting on the fact that, right, yelling, I feel like, is a sign, is often an output of unfamiliarity, right? So that suddenly men were in positions that they had been groomed to kind of, well, not be disengaged from. I do think like many fathers these days are quite engaged, but they're secondary, right? Like the prime manager was someone else and suddenly they were in charge. And it's, yeah, I can imagine that being very destabilizing and that one might raise one's voice if that happens. But like, you know, the kind of the way basically, you know, there's a kind of a studied incompetence that comes with the inability to share parenting responsibilities equitably, that, you know, the moment you remove one of the buttresses that were holding the whole thing up, it just all comes apart.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, the pre-pandemic research shows that dads actually enjoyed time with their kids, more than moms did. And that was in part because before the pandemic, the disproportionate share of the time that dads were spending with their children was oftentimes in the presence of another adult. It was often two parents at home. Right. And it was oftentimes during sort of the fun parts of parenting, you know, family dinners, yeah, or, you know, activities, or kind of the things that are sort of lower stress parts of parenting. Well, disproportionately, even before the pandemic, the parts of parenting that fell to moms were things like, you know, bath time, getting the kids ready for school, trying to do all the logistical work of parenting and managing
doctor's appointments,
scheduling
hair.
And so I
fucking
think it's not
hair. Well, I should say, you know, we're two men raising a daughter who loves things in her hair, and we've never put anything in her hair. It's just like we have our hands like attached to her hair, and we're like, I don't know how this happened. It's like, you know, we're absolutely unprepared for it, and we're learning, but like, it's like literally we're like, can we experiment on your kid, because we need to get better at this.
Yeah, and it takes time, and it's not fun, and it leads to fights and conflicts, and
totally. You show up to school with your kid looking like, you know, they just like emerge from like an ant hive or something like that. Ant hill, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, God, yes. Adrian, you've also been a part of I'm speaking anecdotally, not based on research. One thing that I noticed in the pandemic and its aftermath, if we can call the present that, is that so many childcare centers shuttered, you know, childcare ceased to exist for a moment. That I've noticed, I had a lot of friends, Adrian, among them, like have babies in that 4 year 2020 to 2024 window. And I've noticed anecdotally that it's become much less normalized to have that kid in full-time daycare starting at several months of age so that the parent can go back to work. And I anecdotally, again, would attribute this partially to like their more limited options for daycare. It's harder to find. But also, I think American families, to a degree, normalized the condition of just having a kid at home while you're working. Like, is that something you saw at all in your research, Jess?
Yeah, certainly for families, especially ones that had new babies during the pandemic in the wake of, you know, had access to things like remote work. I do think that I've seen a sort of growing trend among families of treating remote work as a substitute for childcare in a way that to me seems very troubling, almost every family who tries this realizes very quickly its limits, in the sense that, yes, it might work for a very brief window, maybe those first 2 to 3 months where the baby
is sleeping. When the kid is not mobile and sleeping alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But as soon as you get to that point where they are awake most of the day, where they are mobile, where they are, you know, where they need interaction, I mean, it very quickly breaks down. And so I think I worry that this will turn into a substitute for a push both for universal paid family leave, in the sense that it kind of makes it seem like, oh, you can go back to work right away, you don't need paid leave. And then also undermines support for things like universal childcare, and that there's this assumption that, oh, you don't actually need childcare if you can just do this work with your child at home. But it's, you know, I talked to one low-income Black mom who was working actually remotely before the pandemic, even. She was working as a customer service rep and had taken that job specifically because it allowed her to work remotely and meant she could have like avoid paying for after school care and kind of sick daycare and have a sort of backup. But this was, I mean, when things shut down, when this became her full-time arrangement, I mean, she talked about how the guilt that she felt that her kids needed her and that she couldn't be there for. She talked about how I need to not clock out mentally as a mother, you know, when I clock out of work at the end of the day. And she's so tired from dealing with everybody's problems on her phone calls and then everybody's problems at home. And this was just, you know, it's an unsustainable system that, you know, it seems appealing on some level. And actually the research there too, though, suggests that women are penalized for taking remote work options in ways that men aren't. And so I'm worried too about how this will further exacerbate, you know, gender pay disparities and kind of gendered opportunities in the workforce because of, not that remote work isn't a great option, but I don't think it is, should be treated as a sort of substitute for childcare.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost certainly going to be the first wave of firings at any given job, right? I mean, it basically, especially because like the jobs that we tend to think can be remoted right now is actually pretty limited, and it's starting to sort of, I think, kind of push down a little bit. And of course, like they're already kind of underpaid because they can quote unquote live anywhere, even though of course like 90% of the cases they live in the same zip code as the work they're doing. But yeah, I mean, like it would stand to reason that that's going to be, you know, if there's a wave of firings, it's going to, you know, office workers are going to be affected way less proportionally than remote, yeah. Right?
You guys just did such a good job laying out the structural risks and precarities of that assumption that it's fine to have a kid home, you know, while you're doing a full-time job. And I feel like what I'm hearing more anecdotally in my social groups is the guilt and the stress that you were naming, Jess, of just like, well, why can't I do this? Everybody said this should be doable. So why is my hair falling out? Why can't I sleep? It's like, well, because this is not a reasonable thing to ask of any human being, and it never was before, you know?
Yeah. And I think it gets at the we're not only facing the sort of childcare crisis types of pressures, but also sort of increased kind of pressures in terms of the ideal worker norm side of the equation too, in the sense that we are, you know, particularly, I mean, other countries like France have legal limits on paid work hours in terms of the number of paid work hours that workers can work in a given week. They have protected vacation time in ways that we, if anything, push workers in the opposite direction and say, if you are engaged in paid work, you should be devoting as you should work as if you don't have children, and you know, and you should parent as if you, you know, don't have a paid job. And so, and that, you know, that tension becomes particularly fraught for mothers who are kind of facing pressures on both sides, and particularly for those who feel who are trying to compete in kind of high level paid work and kind of elite careers, and who are simultaneously trying to prove that they can be this ideal worker while also trying to prove that they can be this ideal mother at home. And it's a sort of automatic recipe for guilt in that sense, given how, and that's what the research shows too. Katie Collins is a sociologist who looks at sort of cross national differences in maternal guilt, and finds that guilt in the US is sort of off the charts compared to other countries that don't kind of put so much that don't put so much on mothers to have to do this work themselves.
That is so pungent to me that someone is researching that, and that the research is revealing that. That's really compelling.
I mean, it's not that surprising now that I think about it, because in some way, right, that's the paradox, right? Like the more time you spend with your child, the more opportunities for guilt there are. If you pick them up from what appears to be a wonderful school and they tell you all about their great day, you're like, I feel like they had a good day. Whereas like if you were with them all that time, like sure, there are going to be dark spots, right? There are going to be moments where you were distracted, mm-hmm. where you said something, you didn't put something right, you like got them upset or whatever, right? Like there's just like a lot more opportunity to be like, I don't know on balance if this was a good day or not. Whereas like you spend 3 fantastic hours with them after daycare, like, yeah, I can imagine you would feel a lot better about it.
Yeah, which bears out in the research in terms of, you know, stay-at-home moms are not in great shape in the U.S., given the kind of pressure that we put on them in terms of mental health, in terms of their, you know, in terms of their well-being. And so there's, and it's in part because many of them are pushed into that kind of, you know, that kind of space, not out of choice, but because we leave them kind of stuck in childcare's missing middle, that they live in families where they earn too much money to qualify for the minimal childcare subsidies that we do provide, but we, you know, make it impossible to afford $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a month for childcare. And so, and this is why roughly 75% of stay-at-home moms in the U.S. are in households with incomes of less than $50,000 a year. And this is because they sort of end up in this situation that is less than ideal given the kinds of supports that we have have for families. I mean, certainly some are able to make it work, but this, you know, this worries me about sort of like the trad wife trend, and that this is sort of promoting this as this potential solution. But it's, you know, in the absence of high levels of support and high levels of economic resources, it's not a sustainable system, and only serves to kind of further kind of gaslight and further kind of guilt moms in the process.
So I read in The Atlantic that the thing we're supposed to do is get married. So the people you're talking about are already married. So what I'm hearing is we should get married harder. So polygamy is what I'm hearing.
Honestly, yeah. The economic research on polycules, very strong, you know, more resources.
Oh, good. Yeah. This is, okay.
And so probably not what The first, Atlantic folks. Is telling us, but yes.
That's right. Yeah. No, they're very much holding up what Jess is saying is unworkable as like, hey, maybe that's the solution. I'm like, yeah, sure. They're like, hey, have we tried just spraying climate change with, you know, I don't know.
Let's do one more study carbons. With the Institute for Family Studies. Maybe that'll do it.
Yeah. But I mean, one thing that I think about as well, this is something that sort of as someone who studies, you know, moral panics around families a lot, the missing middle you talk about, of course, the kind of work that isn't really sustainable. I mean, I'm rephrasing here, but like it isn't really sustainable, but on the other hand, is more or less like, but cannot be. The government will not do it for you. Basically, it's elective. That's also being extended to an absurd extent, right? Like I'm just thinking here of like this, the rise of the. This might be like this is probably fairly. Class specific, but I don't think it's entirely class specific, right? Like the school sports or interscholastic sports industrial complex, like parents of like 12-year-olds are driving everywhere. Like it's just like, you know, I mean, it's the lowest form of care work is probably just like hitting the, you know, flooring the gas pedal. But like at the same time, like it's still a lot of work and it really takes a lot out of you.
Well, and it's not just flooring the gas pedal. It's flooring the gas pedal and then watching a fourth grader play baseball for 2 hours while you entertain his 6-year-old brother during those 2 hours. Yeah. So it's
because I was picturing like he would just hit the flask real hard. But
well, that can happen too, but that doesn't erase any of the other tasks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and certainly in the context of multiple kids, that becomes challenging. And it's even beyond that. It's like the logistical labor that goes into figuring out scheduling of like
who's bringing the snacks this week. Like, where's
who
the uniform?
4:30 practice? You know, who's going to take their time off from paid work to be able to drive to pick up the kid, to take them to soccer, to do all the things? And it's, you know, the mental labor that goes into that, the extra caregiving labor that comes from sitting and, you know, trying to care for the other kid on the sidelines, and certainly, you know, the sort of the pressure that goes along with this in terms of social pressure to have your kids participate in these activities. Certainly amplifies the kind of guilt that families and especially mothers are often facing as they try to navigate these kinds of kind of pressures of what a good childhood is supposed to look like. Though, I mean, on that front, I think we have to question like how much of this is really about what's good for kids and how much of this is about sort of parents' fears around, you know, the kind of unequal society that we live in. I talk about sort of the myth of meritocracy and the way that this myth and other myths tend to operate to sort of delude us into believing that we don't need a social safety net and divide us in ways that keep us focused on competing with each other and helping our kids compete with each other to get ahead in a deeply unequal society, as opposed to seeing how a stronger social safety net would reduce some of those competitive pressures, would reduce some of those, you know, the feelings that we have where we need to prove ourselves or prove our kids is better because we'd have more equitable opportunities for all. And so I think these things are all sort of connected in the way that they operate to amplify this labor and make it seem necessary, given the kinds of inequality that we face.
Well, and move it back in time, right? Like they're really like the fact that you have to drive a 5-year-old around sometimes like makes sense. The fact that the same is true for a 15-year-old is kind of wild, right? Like what you know. And but of course that's true, right? I mean, like we've half of our entertainment is like true crime that's supposed to tell us that like letting a 14-year-old out on their bike is somehow like tantamount to like handing them over to like, you know, a serial killer or whatever, right? Like we're extending that kind of vision of motherhood past the point where you're like, yes, I don't know if I would trust a 5-year-old to cross a highway, but like, right, like by basically keeping women as mothers for as long as humanly possible, it seems intentional, right? Like it's meant to, as you say, like create this casualized workforce that you can tap as a reserve, but that you can also sort of sideline again when if you know wages get too high or inflation gets out of control.
Absolutely. And it gets to this idea that we treat mothers, I mean, we valorize mothers as sort of the superheroes that are the only ones capable of protecting their kids or keeping them safe from harm. And that valorization, it sort of sounds good in theory, but what it means is that we can very easily use fear-mongering as a way to kind of persuade mothers that they have to sacrifice themselves, that they have to do more caregiving labor, that they have to kind of guard their kids more carefully, whether that's against, you know, the risks of letting them walk to the counter, like the corner store by themselves, or whether that's against things like public schooling with sort of the panics around CRT or around transgender kids. I mean, we've seen so much of this fear mongering, and arguably it's very much directed at maintaining that kind of, you know, maintaining the unpaid labor of women and kind of forcing them to focus as much energy as possible on the sort of insular concerns of their families and not on, you know, how we could restructure society in ways that would actually make all of us safer instead.
This is such a silly connection to make, but I'm just thinking about how, Jess, what all of your research points to is there is a snapping point. Like every single human being, and particularly every single parent, has only so much they can bear. And I was just like, when have I reached my snapping point and how does that reflect these policy truths? And I was thinking about this past Christmas, my kids came home talking about Elf on a Shelf. And I was just like, absolutely the fuck not. This is where the water's edge, like, no, there will not be fucking elves on this shelf. Like, I'm not adding that to the list of holiday tasks, you know? And I don't know why this was the snapping point, but this was the snapping point. And everyone has their own version of that. And I love that the research illustrates that.
Yeah, and it's certainly, I mean, I think both to the point of snapping points and then also the kinds of choices. And like, there's not, in this kind of a structural system, there's not much that we as individuals can do to fight back against the sort of, the way that our policy choices are structured against us to create no. this kind of labor. There are small things we can do to fight back against yes. this. You know, not doing Elf on the Shelf. We don't, you know.
No elves.
Yeah. No elves. No, we choose not to do Santa in our house, which has gotten us a lot of social flack, but also means that we can have different conversations with our kids and means that we can, you know, talk about sort of inequalities and why some kids would get some gifts and some kids wouldn't. And means that we can, it takes different kinds of labor, but it reduces some of the kinds of labor involved with
you. Brave soul. I am so impressed that you canned Santa in Wisconsin, Jess. I think you might be super Bob. Can you just tell me a little bit about the social flack? Like, I'm on the edge of my seat.
I mean, this is a place where, I mean, so we both, my husband and I grew up, you know, both in very Catholic, very religious, very, you know, kind of pro-Santa family kind of situations, where this was part of the magic of Christmas growing up. Mm-hmm. And so certainly our families, I think, were both a little surprised and concerned about this idea that our kids would grow up without that kind of magical influence in their lives. And I think, you know, we've been able to sort of hold off on it. Our kids are, you know, 10 and 6 now and have never
our
really
our kids
done
are exactly the same definitely. Age. I intuited that. Yeah. That is fabulous. Good for you.
It's been, and you know, having to talk to them about how do you navigate this at school? You know, how do you talk about, like, how do we treat the fact that other kids may, you know, other families may choose to use this as a ritual that they do or as a game that they play when they were little. Mm-hmm. We often talked about it as sort of a game. And kind of helping them to respect that we have to be mindful of that, and we can't just sort of call people out if they believe something different, but that this is how we do things as a family and that that's okay. And for the most part, it's worked out fine. We also don't do things like tooth fairies and Easter bunnies. And so it's maybe a little less magic, but we try to find magic that we can put in the kids' lives in other ways.
If you want to just make your next book a quick parenting guide, I would personally make it a bestseller because everything you're saying is just like music to my ear.
You should call it Killing Santa. It's going to be an immediate bestseller.
Okay, well, I think we have to respect the time of all three working parents in this conversation. The book is Holding It Together. The author is Jessica Calarco. We are so excited about it. Jessica, remind us of the exact pub date so people can rush to their bookstore.
Coming out June 4th.
June 4th. Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. This has been a lovely conversation, and I appreciate both of your time.
Thank you. That's
such great. A pleasure. Take care.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.